This is the Business Report with Gary Strubel on Nova 103.5.
It's Thursday evening, and of course, here on Nova 103.5, that means it's time now for the Business Report. And we take a look at some of the biggest stories in Namibia and even on the continent that have popped up over the last week or so, and speak to some of the most interesting people. Our lead story this evening, we speak to Nicholas Lecomte from HDF Energy, the first green hydrogen plant due to start operation here in Africa, in Namibia. Dion Kellerman, the CEO of ICT Hubs, joins us in the spotlight. Stuart Lohman, as always, gives us some background on some of the big stories happening down in South Africa. And Hey Dawn, the CEO of Osino Resources, gives us his impressions of the market watch. Sonia Kutsi also speaks to us about internships. Lots more coming up in the show, but before we get to any of that, let's start out with the business flash briefing.
Rebuilding the economy starts now. RMB Namibia Corporate and Investment Banking, proud partner of BizNews.
With your BizNews, I'm Charlize Maslengle. Listed financial services group Capricorn Limited, which owns Bank Windhoek, says it recorded an after-tax profit of 1.15 billion Namibian dollars for the year ended 30th June 2022. The CEO of the Namibia Chamber of Commerce and Industry, Charity Muiwa, has chastised the implementation of laws and regulations that are making it difficult for startup businesses to flourish. Ebanks, a global payments fintech company founded in Latin America, has announced plans to expand its operations and payment solutions to the African continent, which it believes is the next big growth frontier for digital payments and the digital market during the 2020s. And Tesla was sued on Wednesday in a proposed class action accusing Elon Musk's electric car company of misleading the public by falsely advertising its autopilot and full self-driving features. I'm Charlize Maslengle. Stay tuned for more updates.
A sudden storm shouldn't disrupt your long-term outlook. Access RMB's flexible short-term liquidity. Rebuilding our economy starts now. RMB Namibia, a division of First National Bank of Namibia Limited.
Gary Strubel on the Business Report.
The lead story is proudly brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future.
French independent power producer HDF Energy expects its green hydrogen power plant in Namibia, this is Africa's first, to start producing electricity by 2024. Once operational, the $3.1 billion, and that's Namibia dollar Swakopmund project, will supply clean electricity power 24 hours a day, all year round, boosting electricity supply in the Southern African nation that still imports around 40% of its power from South Africa. Angie Scholes spoke to Nicholas Lecomte, HDF Energy Director for Southern Africa.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Mr. Lecomte. My first question to you is, how does it feel to be part of Namibia's green hydrogen launch and to build the first plant in the country?
Oh, it's a nice question. I mean, it's a first for Namibia, but it may be a first for Africa as well. So it's how Namibia positions itself as that country leading the pack. If we put a bit of context, the green hydrogen revolution is happening, and one of the key parameters here is that Europe wants a lot of it, cannot produce it in Europe, not all of it, and it has to be done with Africa. And this is how Africa can now take that opportunity to be an early mover, and there's somehow a redistribution of cards on a global scale. And so Namibia and the Arambe plan, the number two, the leadership of the presidency on the front of green hydrogen and the departments is creating that context that enables developers like HDF to prefer Namibia to develop a project.
Wonderful. So looking at employment, what employment opportunities would essentially come from the construction phase of this project?
So we are developing the project, trying to maximize the Namibian component at all levels. So we are looking, for example, and I would come to the job discussion just now, but we are looking, for example, at inviting broad-based Namibian investors to the project. We are looking at contractors, localizing skills, And a very simple example, when it was time to do some visuals for the project, we actually trained Namibians to do them. And now they are doing it for the project and for other projects. There's this willingness to maximize the benefits for Namibia. But I would also say, because we are somehow Namibians, I'm personally married with a Namibian lady. My son is Namibian. So my family is that side. You know, we want to see Namibia succeeding. But when it comes down to jobs, so we are looking at a big number of 2,000 jobs between the construction and operation, but the majority of them are for construction. And we're obviously looking at what would be direct jobs, which is who we employ and our subcontractor employ. And the jobs that would be more indirect, they would need to eat the caterer. Yeah, the food truck is a good example, because these people on the construction side, they would want to go get something. And so we are also accounting for indirect jobs and induced. So these are the numbers we're looking at. And we're also looking at maximizing the Namibians in the jobs. Good news, a fair majority of those jobs that we need to build our hydrogen power plant, jobs where Namibians can access, they can be trained, or they are ready to take those jobs. It's not because we talk about hydrogen that suddenly this is something which is not achievable.
Then, sir, what levels of power do you expect the plant to generate once it is operational? And tell us, will this alleviate the need to import electricity from neighboring countries for Namibia?
Yes, it will. So we're looking at an output of 30 megawatts during the day, evening peak, and 6 megawatts at night. So what we would typically call a residential generation profile. So this is the first project, and we look for more. But this project, it's not only providing electricity. So we have calculated 142 gigawatt hour per year. This is at least the consumption of 140,000 inhabitants. Depend the ratio you use, but we like to be conservative. It's probably more. So that gives a good indication of how much quantity of electricity we are doing. But what is essential, it's not only about electricity. It's also about grid services. So today, Namibia is not only dependent of neighboring countries for electricity. Namibia is also dependent on grid services. The Namibian grid would not be able to operate without the interconnection with neighboring countries. And if the national grid collapses, we need the neighbors to assist into reigniting. So by localizing, by implementing projects in country, you don't get the electricity only. You also get those grid services, because our technology, the name of it is Renew Stable. Our technology is grid supporting. It can contribute to a black start if the grid has collapsed. It stabilizes the grid and typically reduces the risk of interruptions. So it has also these ancillary services, those services to the grid that are needed to enhance the self-reliance of Namibia.
Mr. Leconte, how would you explain to a layman how this plant would produce electricity? Green hydrogen is a new concept for Namibians, and many do not understand the technicalities that come with it. How can we simplify the operations for everyone to understand and become excited about this wonderful innovation?
Okay, great. So I would say, in simple terms, a couple of decades ago, that was the boom of renewables, wind power and solar power, but those are intermittent, and there is a level of unpredictability on how much power you will get. That new technology combines renewables, those ones, intermittent, with storage components. There is a component of batteries, or typical, the utility scale version of the one in your car, and a component which is about green hydrogen. So when we have this primary source of power, the photovoltaic, during the day, we not only produce electricity, we also charge the batteries, but we produce hydrogen, splitting water into hydrogen and oxygen. And at night, when there is no more sun to deliver the power, we are taking our storage and using it. We are taking the hydrogen, which has been stored, recombining with oxygen, and you get chemical reaction, you get water, your water back, and your power back on demand. You adjust the flow of hydrogen to get your power back. So our technology, it's called the Renew Stable. It's a combination of renewables and that stability that has been missing with the renewables. So it's very much a revolution.
Definitely. Then, sir, how will this contribute to the decarbonization goals of the country and essentially the world in reaching the zero emissions targets?
I mean, this is an excellent solution in the sense that you get the services to the grid, the supporting services, ancillary services of certain other technologies that are carbon emitting that we have been needing. But this is the renew stable does not emit carbon during its operation. So we are looking at very beneficial type of grid services and electricity and a green technology. So this is a solution that we want to see deployed more and over time in substitution of more traditional carbon emitting technologies. But I mean, what is also very interesting and for Namibia is that this project, even if it's a project about electricity and the other projects that we are talking about in Namibia, essentially about the fuel, the green fuel for cars, domestic and for export for Europe in particular, light mobility, heavy mobility. By doing a first project as early as next year, we start construction next year and we will open commission in 2024. It's about doing it already and building capacities in Namibia with Namibians for those new bricks of that technology, for that new technology. So we are actually preparing the country with a first project. I like to call it a foundation or a stepping stone into the building. Then the country is actually getting to address, to getting ready for other segments. And we start decarbonizing mobility. Mm. So we are getting closer to decarbonizing mobility. And in a few years in Namibia, we will be seeing those cars, the fuel cell cars, running on the green hydrogen. And when they run, their exhaust is water. So we would have substituted, we will substitute progressively over time, the petrol which emits carbon by the green hydrogen.
What other projects is HDF involved in or planned for the near future after this Namibian project?
I mean, soon we will be announcing a few projects in the region. And soon after, we'll be announcing a project in East Africa. So the team of HDF is spread across seven countries now, and we are developing in various countries. So it's almost, you know, I take it as a mission to say the different countries, they need to be offered that opportunity of a first green hydrogen power plant. Let's give that opportunity to Africa. So we are going to the countries and offering the opportunity. And it happened that Namibia has been extremely receptive, and this is where things have been progressing the fastest.
Yes. How does this tie into the greater aim and strategic goals of the company for the long-term future?
I mean, the company is looking at developing more of these projects. So this is definitely aligned with the strategy. Yeah. So more power plants. But the company is also in partnerships with reputable partners, investigating how those fuel cells we use for power plants, like the one in Swakopmund, how we can adapt it to railway, how we can adapt it to boats. So, I mean, the company may start also addressing other segments at some point.
Then, Mr. Leconte, just a last question. What is HDF's role in the achievement of zero emission target? And what role do you essentially plan to play in the achievement of the global goal?
By doing power plants with no emission or very limited emission.
Yes.
And coming in replacement of older power plants, which are carbon emitting. We are substituting carbon emitting by non-carbon emitting power plants. So we are effectively contributing to a world where emissions would be reduced, less and limited. So we are playing our part on the electricity sector. We are also looking at how we can play our part on other segments like railway and vessels.
Mr. Leconte, I say thank you so much for your time.
I thank you very much.
It was lovely to talk to you, and hopefully before the project starts, we can talk again.
Very good. We will be ready to talk. I think it's important for us to engage with our stakeholders. We want a lot of transparency in the process, and this is new, so we also want to educate. So we are very happy to do so.
The lead story was proudly brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future.
The Business Report. Podcasts on nova.com.na. Namibia's business leader on Nova 1035.
In this week's Spotlight, Angie Skoltz chats to Dion Kellerman, the CEO of Africa IT Hubs.
My first question to you is, tell us a bit about yourself. Where do your roots grow from childhood?
Well, it's a little bit of a diverse background. My mom being a Namibian, hence that's where I get my Namibian roots from. And she grew up in a little town just about, 80 kilometers out of Windhoek called Rehoboth. And between Rehoboth, Windhoek and Cape Town is basically where I did most of my growing up. So holidays were most of the time on the farm, the family farm at Kalkrand, about 100 k's from here. And schooling was in Cape Town at Wynberg Boys. So very different background, very much a cosmopolitan city life. And obviously on the other side, very much a Rehoboth small town type of mindset. So I think I've got the best of both, and I'm using it to my advantage.
Yes. How important is history and, coupled with education for you as a person?
Well, I think, history really shouldn't repeat itself, or let us rather say the bad parts of history, if I may. And we should really learn from those mistakes that was done by people previously and use it to our advantage and make sure that those things do not happen in the future. And things that have happened good in the past, to see how we can make improvements on them. History does play quite a large part in terms of how we move forward, but we shouldn't spend too much time on it. We should more spend time on innovation and being creative moving forward.
What did you study and how does your educational experience fuel your drive for success in the ITC industry?
It's a good question, and a question that I always answer with, I have no formal education. Other than up till grade 12. I think most of my learning was done by hard knocks and I paid for that for learning in the real world. And I think you either go through formal education and you accelerate a little bit, and then obviously you get real projects where you can implement those skills, or you physically have to pay by virtue of time or money when you're learning while doing those projects without any formal education. And you tend to learn a lot faster because those mistakes cost you a ton of money if you don't get them right. So, just a very lateral thinker. I did go to university by rite of passage. I went to UWC for a year or two, BCom administration. It wasn't for me, but I think at that time, I think that was about 2003, everyone was told, go to varsity, you got to go to varsity after school. Not really knowing exactly what to study, not knowing what you're going to use that studies for. And I think that's where the bridge between formal education and skills development really is quite important. And it meant a world for me when I was actually in the job market and going from place to place, trying to actually find what skill I'm really good at and I can add value to a specific organization. And quickly learned that formal education doesn't mean anything if you can't implement that education.
Yeah. How did you end up in the ICT industry? Was this always an interest, or what happened, that you ended up, or is it just by chance?
I've never had a passion for IT, if I can say that. I've got a passion for business. And by virtue of that, it's just solving a need. And I saw that the next need was going to be IT driven, and more specifically, went from a managed services house, which we are. And we sort of honed on the skills in terms of software development, which is what we tend to specialize in at the moment. It's one of my companies. And the other one is Africa IT Hubs, which is a skills development company. So it's quite married nicely together. And both companies came about by virtue of trying to solve a problem that exists in the market. We need skills development, we need jobs, we need entrepreneurs, and we need software and IT to drive the African footprint in terms of being sustainable and competing on, in global markets. And everyone's talking about fourth industrial revolution, so I'm not going to bore you with that. But if we're going to be in manufacturing and distribution, the only way to actually add value and compete on those markets is by means of IT.
What role do you see social media play in the business world, taking into account the massive usage we see in the current day and age, and of course, the increasing usage of social media?
Yeah, no, massively. I mean, if you're not on social media platforms, are you really a company in this day and age, you know? I mean, the platforms are free. They're very usable. There's fantastic PR companies out there. We use a few of them. We do some things ourselves. And we've grown. I think we've been in Vintage now for just shy of a year. Mm-hmm. And just by virtue of social media, we've grown astronomically. And I think using social media properly can really articulate the vision and the mission of your company, which is one thing. Culture, what it stands for, which is one of the things that I'm quite passionate about, is really a very human culture-centric business where we really put our people first. So it's what drives the business. And the social media platforms allow you to articulate what you are about and gives you a little bit more of that personal touch as opposed to just be a brochure or a corporate profile or a name on a letterhead. People can actually now feel what the business is trying to portray and what sort of culture and what sort of environment the business is about. And if their views and their visions can actually be married and integrated with that of a company and really a mean for a good, smart collaboration. So I think social media used wisely, definitely a fantastic tool, and not only for acquisition, but also for making people understand what you're trying to achieve in the market, because it's not just about the bottom line.
Yeah. Then, sir, with COVID, we saw all businesses forced to make use of online platforms. Do you think that many of them were ready for this forced move? Could it have been done better, you know, with more planning and time?
So, I mean, that's a two-part question, right? So I'm going to answer the first one. First part first. Were they ready? Yes and no. Some were ready, some won't. A majority won't. So that's number one. Number two, could you plan better? Absolutely. But I mean, COVID really caught us off guard. So, I mean, you can only plan so much. I mean, it's a random act. So, I mean, we can plan all day long, but these things are always going to catch us off guard. Can planning be better? Yes. By virtue of having a proper, solid 5-year, 10-year ICT plan, blueprint, making sure that obviously you mitigate all your risks, that you have a solid ICT blueprint, obviously, with your ICT managed services provider, and that obviously they try to really mitigate all that exposure that exists for you as an organization, and that you understand the risks. What could they have done better? I think for the longest time, you know, ICT purchase or ICT conversation generally have with a IT manager or potentially the accountant or the CFO of the business was a grudge purchase. And people saw it the same way, like playing SARS. It's something they have to do, not something that they really see as an added benefit. And I think COVID has proven how ICT and IT can obviously play a role in really assisting businesses in driving competition and being a competitive edge in the market and gain some additional market percentage. So people have changed their mind from it's a grudge purchase, and COVID had obviously shown people how they can add value and reduce costs by getting out of the office, you know.
And then we're getting to the good part now. Mr. Kellerman, please pick us your favorite song that you like.
My favorite song at the moment, one that's driving everyone crazy, in my family anyway, is Last by Burna Boy.
I didn't expect that one.
Yeah, you gotta wake up.
You go bow for the result. Nothing to discuss, cause I did win by default and without any doubt. I'm a me happy adult, I'm not feed the girl, I'm not gonna feed the choice out. I'm a mind that's with the talk. I put my life into my job and I know I'm in trouble. She manipulated my love. I know holy and I know that kebo like the Baba Prayo. I
Obama. I dey try to buy moto, want Toyota Corolla. My feelings been dey swing like Django Loba. Feelings been dey swing like Django Loba. Now you crash your Ferrari for Lucky Bona. Now see Martin remake could have been all over. My feelings today swing like Django Loba. Feelings today swing like Timbani catch you, at you. I'm a white dog in Venice. Why you say I did nothing for you when if I do anything you want me to do?
If businesses do not keep up with the trend of social media,
yes,
what could their future outcome be? And how can a small business make the shift from a physical business to the virtual world to ensure continued sustainability in the ever-evolving online framework, sir?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So your first question is obviously how do they remain relevant with use of social media trends? I think if you're not following those trends, if you don't have an in-house resource, if you don't have a dedicated person, if you don't have a PR company doing it for you, you're going to struggle to remain relevant in the market. Keeping up with those social media trends, being on all those social media platforms, and having a good creative marketing team so that you're obviously fun, vibrant, and relevant in that space. If you don't, you simply will become archaic. And I think we've seen it with a few people, a few businesses that obviously they weren't relevant. They haven't stayed on board. Smaller companies have come up and obviously gained some market share because of what they're articulating, as we said early on, by remaining relevant and really just articulating their message in a fun, vibrant way that obviously consumers can consume. I mean, our consumption of information has changed over the years. People aren't spending time on watching adverts anymore. People are skipping those things. And they're on TikTok, they're on Facebook, they're on YouTube. You know, I mean, YouTube has no adverts now where you can purchase. So it's all these things. So you need to remain relevant on those specific platforms and create content that's relevant to that specific consumer. And then the second part was, how does a business remain sustainable?
Yes, yes.
In the ever-evolving IT trends.
Yeah.
It's once again, it's thinking with regards to your ICT blueprint. You've got to remain relevant. It's not what problem you're solving now. That's number one. But number two is, how do you remain relevant in 10 years' time? And how do you mitigate the exposure in terms of your competitive advantage? So I think it's very important that we don't only plan for what we're wanting to do now. We plan for what we're wanting to do in 10 years' time and how we remain relevant. So ICT trends will change. And as we're seeing now, people are not in office anymore, but they are 100% online. They're using technology. They're using Teams, Microsoft Teams. They're using their phones as opposed to a physical phone. They're using virtual phones. By virtue of that, they're able to operate absolutely as normal.
Mr. Kalaman, just the last question, time's running out. You have been vocal at many conferences around the Southern African continent about ITC involvement in businesses. What would be your elevator delivery pitch for companies that need this support, combining all your thoughts in 30-second piece of advice?
Yeah, I think from my side, ICT is the future of South Africa, of Namibia, of SADC, and like you said, Southern Africa. If we're not going to use ICT and specific software development to drive manufacturing and distribution so that we can become a global player, then we're in a world of hurt. So I think by virtue of that, reach out, deal with your managed service provider partner, and discuss what options you have in terms of creating more efficiency and optimization within your business. And how you can compete on different markets and open different markets by use of future-proofing your business with regards to ICT planning.
Thank you so much for your time, Mr. Kalaman.
Absolute wonder. Thank you very much for having me. Much appreciated.
The Business Report. Namibia's business leader on Nova 103.5.
The Biz News Wrap is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology and comfort. Book your test drive today at M&Z Motors. M&Z Motors is proud to introduce the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology, and comfort. Contact M&Z Jeep and Fiat Group today for your test drive or visit the M&Z Jeep and Fiat Group Facebook page and check out their great offers. Jeep, go anywhere, do anything.
And welcome back to the Business Report. And as always, every week we get a chance to look down south, have a look at what our South African cousins are up to. And that's with our publishing partners, biznews.com. Stuart Lone joins us on the line. Stuart, welcome back to the show. And I now see, let's get off to the good news, load shedding predicted for 49 out of 52 weeks for the next 12 months. That's absolutely insane.
Yeah, it's not a running joke, because when you live it, it really isn't a joke, as I'm sure you can talk about personal experiences. But it just doesn't seem to end in sight. It's this power plant goes, under maintenance, falls apart, cut down three generating units at Kendall, Kuba goes down, it's like never ending. It's almost like that classic sales pitch back in the day when they were told to sell more, sell on more power rather than maintain, because you weren't incentivized to maintain. And now you feel the effects of that type of policy. But it's hard to do business. I mean, it's very, how would I say, for people working remotely as well, the infrastructure costs, it's a big problem. You talk about that. They had a story the other day, 100 days already of load shedding this year and more to come. Stage four.
I suppose if we're going to have a rant, then let's have a good one. The story came through during the course of the week that the reason the Kuberg, that's of course South Africa's nuclear plant in the Western Cape, the only nuclear plant, that the reason that's offline is there was a new generator being fitted, 5 billion rands worth of new generator, 360 tons apparently. I might be off there, but I think that's an incredibly heavy unit. And it got dropped onto the factory floor, and that's the reason they haven't been able to bring that back online. I mean, that's just the level of incompetence that's now unsurpassed.
Yeah, I mean, that incompetence seems to come through across the board, though, Gary. I know we'll talk about R.W. Johnson, but the Business Conference, one of the viral speaks was from Rob Herzog. And he just looked at the ineptitude and incompetence of the people running the show. And I mean, all things are drip from the top. So if you've got this ineptitude that's leading a country, I mean, I'm not sure there's no sort of explanation for it, but it makes sense if there's no sort of people being held to account, et cetera. But that dropping, that story on the nuclear plant is just mind boggling. But what do you do? And it's delays. The problem with Kuberg, it's delaying the future of the plant, because I think in the next 2 or 3 years it actually has to come offline if they don't do certain things, because it'll run its course. So it's obviously a big push to renewables, but is renewables going to fill all of that some people say not. So you need these baseload power blocks, and it's a big concern because if stage four we are at the moment, you know, everyone jokes about a stage eight, but it's not a funny joke. That's real problems.
Okay, so let's switch now to a piece that I found fascinating on the site, and that's someone Alec talks about a lot in his newsletters, R.W. Johnson. Alec's posted a piece and then a video of him speaking. This was now at your conference in the Berg nearly 2 weeks ago now. Perhaps just give us a sense of what that's about. It's certainly elicited a lot of response, as has Rob Hersoff again climbing into the ANC. But R.W. Johnson, who is he and what's he saying?
Yeah, R.W.'s got a rich academic history. I've been studied at Oxford, emeritus as well. South African, you know, not by birth, but a big interest in South Africa through the struggle as well. I mean, if you look at his history in terms of writing, he wrote a book, I think it's 1977, on how long will South Africa, you know, survive. So, and then he updated in 2015. But he just looks at the history of the ANC. I mean, he talks about how in the early 90s, he spoke to Tony Leon about cadre deployments and how this will be the end of the country in a sense. And that's ultimately what we've seen coming to fruition here. It's the cadre deployment that's deployed in the ANC and these people being put into positions because not because of the competence, but because it's one of the cadres, friends of friends. And that's how the circle works. And that's the basis of not what he says, but he just unpacks history, looks at these sort of things that have happened and how it's all playing out now. But I think he also picks on some of the challenges in removing the ANC, Gary. It's not as simple as people might seem. The opposition is not sort of followed as strong as you need. I mean, in first world countries, you generally have two strong oppositions. You know, the one in power and the opposition are quite closely matched. Here it's going to take coalition politics, all these things that seem to bring about change, but aren't easy. If we look at what's happening in Johannesburg at the moment with that coalition, it seems to be very messy. If we look at early days in Cape Town, before the DA were in power, a bit messy. But obviously, if you look at what 20 years down the line, what's happened there, maybe that's the story we need to look at, you know, on how it can work and how things can progress. But yes, RW is still asking how long will South Africa survive?
And it's a question that affects the entire region. So another story I picked up on, which is another part of this transition. South Africa, for many, many decades, has been a migrant employment state. We've had people with skills coming in from pretty much everywhere in the world. It hasn't always been particularly straightforward to get in and contribute, but many Africans and internationals have been able to do so. But there was a departure from that policy earlier this year with South Africa announcing they were going to send home a couple of hundred thousand Zimbabweans who are here on special permits. That's now been extended by 6 months, mostly just because no one got processed for the extensions. And now the minister is the South African Minister of Labour and Employment and Labour says it's the employers of foreigners and low-skilled works that are the issue. And they are, in effect, considering criminalizing or making it something that they can come after are the employers of these people, because the people themselves haven't really responded. What do we read into this, and you know, how seriously can we take this?
Yeah, I suppose we have to take it seriously, not necessarily for what it said, but for the outcome. Okay? If we look at a lot of the xenophobic violence, etc., it's all been drummed from this type of rhetoric. So I think we do need to take it seriously. He talks about percentage of turnover penalties, etc., on businesses that employ low-skilled foreigners. But what do you do? I mean, we look at RW in his talk, he spoke about the one shining light that he has is business, you know, and businesses is ultimately what's keeping it going, not politics, but they need to work together. And unfortunately, we know over the last 20 odd years, they don't really work well together. And I know there's all talk about collaboration, coalition, et cetera, but there isn't really any fruit from those trees or the seeds that have been planted. So yeah, it's rhetoric, I think, like we say, who knows where it'll go in terms of defiance, but the concern is not so much what on that, it's what fuels things on the ground. You know, it's that violence that does pop its head every so often in the poorer communities. And we saw what happened in the riots last year. So it's a concern.
It's a real concern for people living on the ground. Here in Namibia, of course, we have possibly the other side of that, which is almost a very protectionist environment where it's incredibly difficult to bring in even scarce and critical skills, where the government feels that its responsibility is to protect opportunities for Namibians first, and then worry about the things Namibians can't do if anyone can prove it can't be done. I was chatting to a Burundian taxi driver and a Zimbabwean taxi driver on a recent business trip, and what both of them echoed to me is their constant fear of death. That the issue isn't so much the permits and visas and so forth, all of which they had in place. They're legally allowed to be in the country. It is the fact that if someone finds out they're from somewhere else, that it isn't a stretch to imagine that they'll be killed for no reason.
No, completely. And that's what as mentioned earlier. It's not necessarily it's the rhetoric and what it creates from the rhetoric. It's how people sort of take what the minister says, etc. And sometimes taken the wrong way, because it's as if the foreigners are stealing their jobs, which is not. it's not the truth, and that's what's taken from it, and that's the worry. It's the perception. It's not what's in the message. It's how the message is perceived from the people on the ground. So yeah, it's interesting though, Gary. We talk about sort of skilled work, migrant work, etc. But if you look, a lot of the other bigger first world countries are also quite protectionist in a sense. You know, there's a lot of skill of requirements needed for people to get these jobs in sort of first world countries. So on the highly skilled level, it makes sense. But on the lower skilled, it's a tough one. I'm not sure. And I do worry about it, because a lot of if you look on the ground, a lot of the people speak about the foreign help, you know, and what do you do if that's taken away? What happens?
Well, interesting, a report out on a different news site that came through this morning that you probably wouldn't have an opportunity to look at yet, but on News 24, a report found that immigrants are less likely to commit crimes than South Africans. They make up 6.5% of the population, and it's impossible for them to be straining the government services, as has many of the ministers have been saying. But despite that, that anti-foreigner sentiment appears to be growing in South Africa. And, of course, that sort of behavior also has the threat to spill over. We've seen Namibians implicated in the Palapala scandal. We saw very recently Namibians killed on the Botswana border in an alleged misunderstanding around fishing or poaching, depending on which side of the story you believe. And all of these little things add up into a space where African countries are trying to get closer together, that in fact they could undermine all of that, with South Africa, of course, being the melting pot for that. What do we see as being an answer here? Is the South African government offering anything that resembles a hope that this isn't going to de-escalate as it has in the past into xenophobic violence?
Sure. Yeah, Garrett, I think you look for an answer. The answer is in sound policy. It's in job creation. It's in employment, in an environment where those things are encouraged. If you look, unfortunately, at policy, look beyond the foreign worker policies. If you look at the BE elements, all these other elements that work against a capital movement, in a sense. And I think at the end of the day, if you want to fix the country, you've got to fix things on the ground. You've got to create jobs, because that all flows through. But in terms of fixing this as it is, I think the minister should just be mindful of what is being said in the public eye. You know, we've got to be careful of what comes out, because, again, it's not necessarily the message they're trying to portray. It's how the message is perceived. And we've seen these things blow out before. So it is a worry. And I'm similar with the stories of the foreign workers and the Ubers and stuff. It's a constant worry, but it's been fueled from the top. So it's a very, and there's little pockets as well. We must also be mindful. It's not the masses that sort of drive these things. It's pockets, you know? So yeah, I'm not sure what the answer is, but it is something that we need to be mindful of. And hopefully we've learned from the 2021 riots, et cetera, but yeah.
Well, the conspiracy theorists would say that it is, in many cases, parts of the ANC thrive when the country is destabilized. So we're going to leave it at that. That's what we've got time for today. Of course, something that does always give hope are sports results. So we got thrashed by England. We mentioned that last week. That didn't work out so well. But the rugby is on the horizon. Argentina on Saturday. Some hope there, at least.
Yeah, nice. scary. And we always look for rugby. It generally gives us the hope. You know, the World Cup's every 12 years. we do hope on that. I think the Argentina game will be tough. We've seen a lot of the world champions, the rugby sort of cup up and down, win one, lose one. So, but we'll be in hope. I know the Aussies are playing the New Zealanders today. So let's see how that one plays out. And yeah.
That's Stuart Lowen from biznews.com. All of these stories, videos, comments, and much more on their website, biznews.com. That's it for this week's BizNews Weekly Wrap.
The BizNews Wrap is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology, and comfort. Book your test drive today at M&Z Motors.
Gary Struble on the Business Report.
Canadian gold developer Osino Resources has announced that the pre-feasibility study of its Twin Hills gold project in Namibia confirms the project is set to become a viable open-pit gold mine that will support economic development in the country. You can read the full press release on the Future Media website, but today I'm speaking to CEO Haya Dawn to find out more. Hello, Mr. Dawn.
Hello. Thank you for having me on your show.
So before we get into the real reason that we're speaking today, Osino Resources is a Canadian company, but you're in fact a born and bred Namibian, right?
Yes. Yes, I am. Obviously, the financing of the company, you know, we're a venture capital mining company, and the financing for these kind of projects is often best found in Canada. And that's why we listed in Canada, but our asset is in Namibia.
Okay. And you've built and operated mines with Rio Tinto, AngloGold, Ashanti, and Goldfields. But you've also got a lot of experience when it comes to gold mining in Namibia because you co-founded the former Oryx Gold Corp, which advanced the Otjikoto Gold Project. So how important is it to you to be involved in the development of Namibia?
I'm a very patriotic citizen. So for me, this is an incredible opportunity to contribute to socioeconomic development. Obviously, in Namibia, jobs are extremely important, and mining has the potential to generate those jobs and stimulate the economy. So that motivates me immensely.
Mm. Let's get to the meat of the chat then. Let's talk about the Twin Hills discovery. Whereabouts is the mine?
So it's not a mine yet. It's currently a deposit. That's what we call it technically. It's gold in the ground. It's in the central part of the country, sort of midway in between Windhoek and the coast, just to the north of the town of Karibib. There, for those of your listeners who know Namibia, there's another gold mine very close by called Navakhab, which used to be owned by AngloGold Ashanti, and we're about 20 kilometers away from there.
Okay, and if I understand things correctly, this isn't the only potential site that Osino is interested in.
No, we started off as an exploration company, so we put a big land package together in Namibia. So we've got lots of licenses all over. We made a name for ourselves as a very innovative and driven explorer, and that's how we found this deposit, literally from under the noses of some much bigger companies. But we are active in the rest of the country on these licenses. So we do hope to make additional discoveries. But, you know, I don't want to be too flippant about it because exploration is obviously a long-term, complicated undertaking. So it's not so easy. But we are active at it.
All right. The Twin Hills literature talks about 5 million tons of ore a year and an annual gold production for the first 10 years of 171,000 ounces. But can you put this into terms of that the average person can understand? How big a mine will this make the Twin Hills project?
Yes, sure. So in our industry, they talk about Tier 1 and Tier 2. So Tier 1 is something that's, let's say world-class, although that's a bit of a loose expression. Ours is a high-quality Tier 2 deposit, meaning it is definitely globally relevant, but Tier 2 is sort of up to 200,000 ounces a year, and we're just below that. So it's quite a large deposit. So the mining operation at 5 million tons per annum throughput, that's a big plant. It's going to be, by quite a long margin, the biggest gold mine in Namibia. I'm scratching my head here trying to come up with comparatives for the average listener, but it's quite a significant operation. I mean, if you look at the capital cost, for example, It's going to. It is definitely one of the major foreign investments in the Namibia to come in the next few years. And you know, of course, it's very tangible and it's near term. That's what makes it attractive. Meaning, it's developing very fast. And maybe I should just add that here. One thing that I'm very proud about is that we've progressed this project from discovery in 2019, geological discovery, to a pre-feasibility study in 3 years is really unheard of. Most projects of this nature in mining take 10 years or so to go through that kind of evolution. So we've been really fast, and we plan to continue to fast track this project.
And the literature says it's an open pit mine rather than an underground one.
Yes, it's an open pit mine. It's still open at depth. What it means, the geology and the gold bearing ore continues at depth. We have drilled it down to about 350 meters so far, but with ongoing drilling, this project will continue to get bigger. When I say get bigger, the ore resource will get bigger, and the life of mine probably will be extended. But the 5 million tons per annum, that's quite a large plant already. So with this pre-feasibility study, we've defined the scope of the project, so we're very certain now what it will look like and feel like. But the gold resource very likely will continue to grow.
You mentioned Navajab as one of the nearby mines, and they've recently moved to augment their open pit with underground mining as well. Is that something that you foresee in the future?
Underground mining, of course, needs higher grades. We've recently started intercepting some of these higher grades. At the moment, we have not looked at underground mining, and because it's not yet necessary. Usually what happens when these open pits get to the end of their lives, as you can imagine, as the hole gets bigger, at some point it does not become economical anymore to mine open pit. And then if your grades are high enough, then you go underground. But in our case, we have not yet looked at it, but I think there's definitely potential for it in the future.
Okay, and that'll obviously then extend the life of the mine.
Yes.
Now, we're all excited about the benefits that the project set to deliver. What kind of timeline? You said everything's working really, really fast. What timeline are we looking at for the project?
Yeah, sure. I mean, of course, things still take time. So I think a realistic timeline, or let's say our internal target, which is quite aggressive, is to conclude our studies in the next, call it 9 months or so, 9 to 12 months at most. So by the middle of next year, we want to have a definitive feasibility study completed. And that's required in order to raise the financing to build this project, because bear in mind, we have to raise a lot of funding, project financing to build this project. So if everything goes to plan, we could potentially commence with construction in the second half of next year. And then there would be a 2-year build period, meaning the first gold production could be expected around the middle of 2025.
Sure. Okay. You mentioned earlier creating jobs and benefiting the country socioeconomically. Is it going to be strictly a mining operation, or are there any plans for upstream activities like local smelting or refining?
No, it's a good question, because people, of course, always say generically, thinking about it, beneficiation is always a good thing. But in gold, it's hard to beneficiate because we're already producing a 99% pure product with gold bars. So, and if you think about it, the processing plant to get the gold to that is already a large beneficiation step. So no, beyond that, it's very unlikely we will produce gold bars and sell them. But you must bear in mind, talking about socioeconomic upliftment, the power and the secondary effects, or the trickle down effects of this kind of capital investment, like procurement of goods and service, taxes, salaries, it's very significant. I mean, even now, whilst we're only an exploration company, I can tell you that by the end of this year, we would have spent close to R1 billion, or Namibian dollar, which is 1-to-1. And we can already feel that impact very strongly in the local town. So lots of small businesses are already benefiting from us now. But, you know, that there will obviously be an immense multiplier once the project actually gets built and starts producing.
That's great news. Thank you very much for your time, Mr. Dawn. I'm sure we'll speak again as the Twin Hills project comes closer and closer to fruition.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having had me on the show.
Thank you.
The Business Report. Podcasts on nova.com.na.
The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Novo 1035.
Salt Essential IT recently launched their Skill Enhancement and Employment Development Program that will see them take in 10 interns at a time for 12 weeks. So we thought it would be a good idea to talk to MD Sonia Kutzer about internships in the Namibian context. Hello, Mrs. Kutzer.
Hi, David. Thank you very much for having me. Looking forward to the chat.
So internships are still relatively new in Namibia. Why was it important for Salt to start offering such a program?
Okay, so firstly, internships are not new. They've been around for quite some time. And Salt used to, in the past, deliver traditional internships.
Mm-hmm.
Seed is a pilot for us. And we're changing the approach to how internships are done in Namibia or in Salt, okay, for that matter.
So why do you think then that internship programs and specifically changing internships programs are important for the country?
A lot of the time when students come from universities, you know, they go into the job market and we all know that horrifying thing of, but you don't have experience, right? And I would say 100% of university programs require some form of practicum, some form of internship completed.
Mm.
And it is to give the student real-time experience in a real-time working environment to enable them that when they go out and say, here's my diploma, here's my degree, to also say, here is my experience.
Mm. So it's more than just those, you know, fulfilling the required number of hours to get your degree. It's a chance to get some really important skills and experience.
Exactly. That's absolutely what it is.
How then can an internship benefit the company offering them, though?
Oh, well. Well, in the first place is it allows us to also evaluate the student studying in that field that is within our organization. Mm-hmm. And this way it also positions us for future employees, prospective employees. Yeah. You get to see what are their work ethics, what are their rate of learning, how do they adapt and adopt a corporate environment.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, it is sussing the future employees for the company. The next leg is that you are creating employable Namibians.
Mm.
So even if you don't employ them, they are employable by others. And something that was brought to our attention recently in the SEED program when we've been having some discussions was that it also creates entrepreneurs, job creators of the future.
Mm.
So, yeah, the benefit for us, it's multi-pronged.
I suppose that's incumbent on having a sort of structured program in place. I mean, we hear these horror stories about interns being placed and for 6 months you end up making the coffee or doing the filing.
Exactly. And I think the challenge with internship programs is that we're not getting sufficient guidance from the universities. What is it they want out of it? They say that they want to position the person with you. They must gain experience in a position or in a speciality. But it's all over the place. So, yes, they do end up making coffee and moving furniture around. And this is totally what we want to break with SEED, is changing the way that we as a company approach the program and make sure that when that seedling blossoms, it is forever.
Okay. Another sort of hot topic around internships and seeing a lot more of it on social media is, I suppose in the past, internships were seen as an unpaid position. Obviously, it costs the company money, but do you believe that interns should be paid for the time that they commit?
Yes and no. let's say from no, in a way you are being paid in terms of hard skills, soft skills, exposure and experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, because a lot of these students have minimal income to pay for their studies or repay their studies, you know, and it's difficult for them. If you like myself, mingle with some of these students, listening to their challenges, to their hardships, how they can't prepare for exam because they couldn't pay for an important textbook.
Mm.
And that payment that you give them, at company discretion, obviously, it helps them to further their studies. It helps them to be better at their studies. It helps them pay rent. It helps them put food on the table. So, yes, I believe that companies should consider a monetary reward for interns.
Getting back to the sort of student side of the equation then, and assuming that they're placed at a company that has a proper structured internship program and they're not just left making coffee or tea, what can the student do to ensure that they get the best out of the program?
Good attitude, okay? Commitment to learning. Initiative. And I think above anything else, understanding that that internship is for yourself. You make of it and you get from it what you put in. Mm. Otherwise, it is just what it is. It's something on paper.
Okay. Speaking about something on paper, you know, in the case of SALT, there's a next step, so to speak, where the top performing interns will be offered a place at your innovation hub that you're going to be launching next year. But when we talk about interning, you know, as an intern going in, as a student, are you going into it expecting to get a job at the company that you're interning at if you perform well? Or do you think that the students should rather see it as a learning experience, something that can make them more attractive to other future employers?
Both, literally both. The first thing is you should understand what you're gaining from this and what it would mean for your future. Secondly, if you are, well, while you're in this internship with this program, you are exposed to that particular company, their employees, their teams, their culture, their values.
Mm-hmm.
And if those resonate with you, make sure that you make the right impressions on the team that engages with you, that when there's a decision, it said, we want that person as part of our team.
Okay. We're talking about internships, but the sort of other side of the coin perhaps is mentorship. And I know that you give a lot of personal attention and guidance to several young Namibians. When does an internship turn into a mentorship, and what's the difference between the two?
An internship is very much job focused, right? This is the job at hand. These are the skills, hard or soft skills, that you are going to need to be successful in this job. A mentorship looks at the whole package. It looks at you as an individual, as a career, bringing personal as well as professional growth to you, so that when you are 50 and you look back, you can say, I have achieved my goals. Mm. I was prepared. I was mentored. I was guided to achieve these successes. So, and a lot of times, I treat it as two individuals, but you get those gems and they actually just adopt you and you run with them for 2 or 3 years. Again, a mentorship is also a very structured program.
Mm-hmm.
Both parties have to come to the party. Both parties give, both parties take, both parties gain from it. But yeah, no, I do love mentoring some of my gems out there in Namibia.
So, I mean, other than sort of being identified as that gem in the internship program, how do interns go about trying to convert the sort of, let's call it a short-term internship, into a longer-term mentorship, you know, not necessarily with the MD of the company, even just with the person that they interned under?
Well, you can basically go and mentor with any idol that you so wish. You should never limit yourself to a direct connection.
Mm-hmm.
The person you interned under might know somebody that is better suited to help you with that future career development, mm-hmm. and they introduce you to that. I know that it's very difficult for our young people to understand where they want to go, what they want to do. But if you want to change an internship into a mentorship, you're going to have to give more than what you're going to get.
Mm.
You really have to be clear on your views. And if you're not, it's okay. You know, then say, I'm studying in this field, I'm doing this internship, but I've got no clear roadmap. And a lot of times, instead of having a mentor assigned to you, a coach could be assigned to you, mm-hmm. a life coach that helps you set those goals and help you grow towards those goals, where a mentorship will then complement that coaching from that area.
And I mean, mentorship's not something just for students. Mentorships are things that can happen throughout your career.
Absolutely. I love mentorships and I love being mentored. I think, giving my age away, in my 20 plus almost 30 years of working, I've had a few very, very brilliant mentors. And it's attributed to them that I am where I am. And right now I have like an unofficial mentor where I go have coffee once every 3 months and just talk about where I see things. Am I on the right path? Mm. Am I thinking the right thing? So, yeah, having those mentors are great.
And things like Twitter, LinkedIn, you know, other social media platforms have made potential mentors that much more easily accessible, let's say. But are there certain ground rules? Are there sort of, you know, a level of professionalism? How do you approach someone? You know, not just completely casually or?
Yeah, I think you go about applying for a mentorship or asking somebody to be your mentor the way that you apply for a position within a company. It is a very formal, it's very professional, it's very official. And you have to understand that person mentoring you is taking time out from their family, from their friends, from their business to spend it with you. So you should treat it as a formal professional engagement. Sometimes lasting friendships develops from this. Sometimes business partnerships develops from this. But it is a formal process and it should be respected and treated as such.
Oh, thank you very much. For anyone who's interested in applying for Salt Seed Internship Program, where can they get some more information?
They can email us innovation@salt.na. We have got a team that responds to incoming emails. Please don't just pop a sentence, I want to know more. Because, guys, running this is a rather busy team. And if you're just propping something out there.
It's the attention economy. You need to stand out.
You need to stand out and you need to be respectful. You know, just saying, hi, I want to know more. What do you want to know more? You know, say, hi, I'm interested in a program. This is my field of study. Will this program complement me or do you recommend something else? You know, give us something to work with. Then just, hi, I want to know more. Well, please go to our website. And that's not being rude. That's just being truthful, you know?
And that's something that counts for sort of any interaction you're having with any company, not just with Salt.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, David. It was nice being back in the studio, and looking forward to lots of seedlings coming out of the program.
There we go.
It's the Business Report with Gary Struble. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Novo 1035.
I'm David Bishop with your weekly economics wrap. Namibia's cattle can once again be exported to South Africa following the lifting of the movement ban imposed for the control of foot and mouth disease outbreaks in the country. The Okakarara constituency says they're at an advanced stage in the planned construction of a new abattoir and feedlot. The Communication Regulatory Authority of Namibia has announced a reduction of mobile and fixed termination rates by 50% to reduce operational costs for telecommunications operators in the country. The Social Security Commission says they have noted with concern that scammers are contacting some SSC clients, requesting them to provide their banking PIN details and other personal information. And Bank of Namibia Governor Johannes Kawakab has called for responsive conditions to enhance economic recovery, saying that even though Namibia presently enjoys stable monetary and financial conditions, which are essential for macroeconomic stability, sustainable economic development in the post-COVID-19 environment will be elusive unless all stakeholders take meaningful actions towards the economic recovery effort. Namibia and Botswana have signed 7 bilateral cooperation agreements, but the government says they are still finalizing the agreement to allow citizens of the countries to cross the border using IDs, despite President Hage Geingob's previous statements. South African political analyst Ralph Matheka, meanwhile, called the move a step in the right direction.
It is a very, very, very progressive move. It is actually going to open opportunities for trade. It will also allow for further collaboration in many other areas. Certainly stability in Botswana and in Namibia is of mutual interest for both countries. Other countries on the continent in the region should monitor this kind of a thing with a view to see what are the lessons, what are the risks. This is pointing in the right direction.
In other local news, with over 700 schools not having internet connections and 33% still without electricity, the Director of ICT Development, Linda Ipinge, has suggested that the budget should include funding for ICT infrastructure, forming PPPs, and power the Universal Service Fund. The Walvis Bay Municipal Council has approved the sale of land for the construction of a vocational training center, and while sticking with education issues, University of Zimbabwe students staged a flash demonstration over the latest round of tuition fees hikes, vowing to boycott lectures until the 1,000% increase is reversed. Looking at news from South Africa, tire manufacturers want government to speed up the introduction of higher import tariffs on cheap Chinese tires, a move that could see the cost of keeping a vehicle on the road get even higher, while businesses say the proposed rate of the country's carbon tax increases will be too steep for businesses and the economy to accommodate, and ministers will meet in the coming days to discuss an investment plan for billions of dollars pledged by rich nations for a transition to green energy. In news that was mostly overshadowed locally by the death of the Queen, weaker than expected GDP numbers have added to concerns in the UK that the country could be heading for a recession, while inflation in the United States remains stubbornly high despite a recent drop in fuel prices, with most analysts suggesting this will convince the Federal Reserve to press on with its plan to keep aggressively raising interest rates. And severe floods in Pakistan may have cost more than $40 billion in damage and economic losses. Finally, the UN urged EU countries on Monday to continue battling climate change and not resort to more fossil fuels in their response to soaring energy prices and fears of winter shortages. And the International Labour Organization says that 50 million people are trapped in modern slavery on any given day, an increase of 9.3 million since the last round of research in 2017.
Namibia's business leader on Nova 1035.
That's it for this week's business report. We're going to have a lot more news, I would imagine, on energy and mining, two sectors where we're going to see big expansion in the Namibian environment over the next few years. Our thanks, as always, to both David Bishop and Angie Schultz, our producer, for their content pieces, and then also to our technical producer, Raymond Ziefeld, for putting everything together. Our thanks to our contributors for joining us, and also to you for listening. You're the ones who make this Namibia's leading business show and number one business podcast. Of course, you can catch that podcast on nova.com.na. Go to podcasts. You can also catch it on your Apple podcast, on any of the podcast stores on Android and on Spotify. You'll find it there as well. So lots of places where you can catch the business report. Thanks for joining. As always, you can let us know if there's stuff you'd like to hear about. TBR, that stands for the business report, at nova.com.na. Pop us a mail. Catch us on Twitter. Send smoke signals. or secret messages buried in chocolate cake. Any way you'd like to get hold of us. Thanks so much for joining us here on the Business Report. We'll be back next week, same time. Have a great weekend.
That was the Business Report on Nova 103.5. Listen to all the segments and previous episodes with our podcast service on nova.com.na. The Business Report was presented by Gary Struble and produced by Angie Scholes and David Bishop. Comments and questions can be sent to tbr@nova.com.na.